I decided to break this podcast up into two parts because one felt really overwhelming to try to fit it all in. I kind of had to pause and take a break. But two, because there are kind of two parts to the story. There was the loss that we walked through and then the loss we almost walked through, the just really traumatic event that followed it, and then all the learnings and the perspectives that came from it as well. So this episode is a follow-up to the previous one. If you didn't listen to the last episode, you might be a little confused by this one, so you might want to pause it and go back. But essentially, I shared my story of our tragic loss of our baby at 17 weeks pregnant, and this is the point in the story where I ended up getting rushed to the hospital because things were very wrong after the delivery. So I'm going to do my best and I'm going to share honestly. And yeah, that's the best I can do. Hey, you're listening to the Luminary Leadership Podcast and I'm your host, Liz. This is the space where we equip overwhelmed entrepreneurs to become the confident, visionary leader their business, team, family, legacy need to win. After working with countless entrepreneurs over the last decade plus, I've noticed this theme. No matter the level of success they achieved, and I've worked with some incredibly successful business owners, they get to this point where they're asking, now what? You know, what am I being called to next? What does next look like? How do I get there? If you're listening to this, you get it. You're craving more impact and you want to feel less frantic and in the weeds of your day-to-day roles. And instead lead with that vision and that peace and that intention and that clarity. You want to wake up each morning with that clarity and vision and the time and the margin to do what you love in your business and in your life with your family. This show is where industry leaders come to grow into their next level of achievement and purpose and impact and legacy. Success in business and true legacy at home. Get ready because we both know you don't just need another strategy. It is time for your breakthrough. So at this point in the process, I was at the hospital and I was thinking I would just get fluids to kind of get my body back on track. I thought maybe I had delivered the placenta that was maybe causing some of the issue that was leading to so much bleeding. And I had requested an ultrasound to confirm that, because if there was no tissue remaining, then I was likely going to be fine and it was just the typical bleeding that comes from having delivered a baby. So in that time at the hospital, I was still consistently bleeding, but they were pumping me with fluids to kind of replace that blood loss. But one thing that they weren't doing was measuring my blood loss. So I was saying, hey guys, I know I'm bleeding more than normal. I've had four babies. And they're responding saying, no, it's probably normal bleeding. And they also confirmed the tissue that I had passed was the placenta. And then ultimately I ended up with an ultrasound where they also said the ultrasound shows that there's no tissue remaining and that you must have passed that placenta. So, you know, this is probably just typical bleeding. And they're talking to me like I've never had a friggin' kid before. I'm like, okay, well, no offense, doc, but I've walked through this a few times and this is not feeling very normal. Not to mention the fact that I was still, if I sat up in the bed, I still felt really dizzy. So despite the fact that there was life force coming back in my body from all the fluids they were pumping me full of, I still didn't feel quite right. Like I still felt very lightheaded. They hadn't tried to get me up to see like if I stood, what would happen. They weren't checking to see how much blood I was losing. There were just a lot of errors that I'm not going to go into fully here, but after a couple hours in the emergency room of just being pumped full of fluids, and they also took my hemoglobin, which they took it right when I arrived. So that's usually on a delay. All this happened in such a tight timeline from our house and at the hospital that I'd only been bleeding for about an hour at that point when they took it, and my levels were really high and normal. They were like 12.6, which is great. Totally normal. So they're like, oh, your hemoglobin's fine. Well, I felt like we were walking them through the process. I was like, you need to test my hemoglobin again. I've been here for multiple hours and I've been bleeding the whole time. You took it when I first arrived, but it's usually on a delay anyway. So I'd only been bleeding for an hour. We need to know where I'm at now. So we kept pushing for additional tests and they were just hemming and hawing. Again, it was a Sunday at a county hospital, which was just a total disaster. Nobody was in. Took forever for the ultrasound person to come in. I won't even go into my experience experience with the ultrasound tech, it was a nightmare. It was an absolute nightmare. I swear this guy just rolled out of bed from like a 3-day bender and just so disrespectful. Like, so what are you in for? Like, I'm a criminal. And I said, like, I just lost my baby. And he's like, so what are we doing an ultrasound for then? Like, just absolutely asinine what we experienced in that room. If I wasn't desperate for the care, I think my husband would have reached across and choked this guy out because it was so bad. And that's, by the way, that's not the worst of it in terms of this guy. But anyway, he leaves. Thank God. Terrible. Whole thing was just a mess. And then the doctor comes back in and he says, great news. We got your ultrasound results back. There's no placenta remaining. Everything looks good. You know, the radiologist said that the tissue, your uterine lining is thickened, but that's totally normal. You just delivered a baby. Of course, they're going to say that. So I'm going to discharge you to go home. And at this point, I'm feeling a little bit better because they're giving me fluids. They're telling me that there's no remaining tissue. And I just want to get home to my kids and my baby. I want to go to bed. I'm so freaking tired. And I hate this hospital. I just want to get out of this hospital. So I was sitting there waiting for them to come in with the discharge papers. But Michael's saying, like, I don't know if this is the right thing. Like, we still haven't gotten answers. You know, shouldn't we be getting her hemoglobin checked again? So he requests another hemoglobin check. So they oblige. They take my blood. And then the nurse, so we haven't gotten the results of that back yet. The nurse comes in with the discharge papers and hands them to me to sign. And then she looks at me and she looks at my blood pressure on the monitor. And she's like, I'm really sorry, but I don't feel comfortable sending you home with a blood pressure that low. Like, it's been dropping ever since you arrived a few hours ago. And we're giving you fluid, so it shouldn't be dropping. And at that point, I was like 78 over 40. And my blood pressure is nowhere near that low normally. So she's like, I'll be right back. So she goes out. She comes back. She said, we just got your hemoglobin back. You've dropped multiple points. So I was down to a hemoglobin level of 9. And this is just in a couple hours. 9 is still not necessarily in the zone where you'd do a transfusion or something. But it's of what was of more concern was where I started and then where I was in such a short window of time. So she finally called OB. Now, this is the part of the story that blows our minds, is that they had said they called OB from the beginning, because this is obviously an obstetrics issue. I was having I just gave birth to a baby and I was hemorrhaging. Like, why am I just seeing a dude ER doc who knows nothing about obstetrics? I could go on a whole tirade about the medical system, but I'll spare you in this particular episode. So they call OB down, and at that point, I'm trying to remember all the pieces in order. That's the tricky part. So the OB comes in, and the first thing she asked me is, well, what did they say during your exam? And I said, I haven't received an exam yet. And she literally mouth hangs open, like, what do you mean you haven't received an exam? They haven't checked how much you're bleeding and, like, done a cervical exam or a pelvic exam? I said, no. So she was blown away by that fact. And she decides she needs to do a full workup to really see what's going on, because I'm obviously bleeding beyond what's normal because my hemoglobin is dropping so rapidly. Well, she starts an exam, and within minutes, I start massively hemorrhaging. Like, if you had a pitcher of water, like a gallon pitcher of water, open mouth pitcher, and one of your crazy kids, like one of mine, comes barreling through the kitchen and knocks it over, and the whole gallon just gushes onto the floor. That was the situation. Within a minute's time, I'm looking around this tiny little ER, and I'm seeing my blood in every corner of the floor. So she jumps back and shouts, we need to get her into surgery immediately. And kind of just rushes out, because the crazy thing about internal bleeding is, like, what are they going to do about it in that room? They have to do surgery to stop that bleeding. They're not going to put pressure on a wound, right? The wound is internal. They're not going to, like, there's nothing they can do to stop it. So they go into action to just prepare to go into surgery. So Michael and I just kind of left as everyone's frantically running around us with a, like, what's happening? Now, the funny thing and a perspective moment for me was when we got there, I had in my mind two things. I was like, really don't want to have surgery. if not necessary, and I really don't want a freaking blood transfusion. I am so neurotic and just attentive to what I put in my body. The thought of taking somebody else's blood who I don't know, how they treat their body or what they inject into their body or what they do with their body, I'm like, that sounds horrible. So when I arrived, I was like, I do not want blood. Well, this starts happening and it's amazing how your mind can just shift to like, I need blood. Like what I once was ready to reject because I'm like, no, I don't, that's not optimal. Everything changes when you're in a moment of need and you realize how little you can control in your life or do control in your life and how much you have to surrender to God to make it to the next moment in your life. So there's this window of time from when I start massively hemorrhaging, which was a big shift from how it had been in the hours leading up to it, to when I ended up in surgery. And in that time, things got crazy, absolutely crazy. So I'm just geysering blood at this point and everybody's running about and I'm feeling my body go. I've never felt this in my life. It wasn't a feeling of just passing out. I'm getting cold. I'm starting to shiver. I'm feeling blood draining out of my body. I am starting to lose consciousness. So their solution is, which is common, lay me down, tip the bed. So my feet are way up in the air and my head is way down by the floor to try and keep me conscious. And at this point, Mike, we're like pulling out all the stops because we need to figure this out. I'm losing so much blood. And just to give you a reference point, women who experience this can lose their life within 5 minutes by the amount of blood the body's able to pump out. So I had already been bleeding for all those hours and then now and some. So I am starting to get really scared. I'm feeling it. Like up to that point, everything was just frustrating and upsetting and I'm still mourning, obviously, and I'm focused on that. And now it's starting to feel a lot more like panic. So Michael has everybody and their mother on the phone. He's conferencing in his dad, who's a doctor, conferencing in my uncle, who's an anesthesiologist, conferencing in his cousin, who's an OB down in down south. So asking all of them, like, what can we do? She's actively bleeding. They're all running around frantically trying to figure this out. So he's shouting out different medications that can help, like, slow bleeding and clot the blood. Do you have this? Do you have that? And they're like, yes, we do. And he's like, well, why aren't you giving it to her? Why am I a layperson suggesting what you guys should be doing medically to stop my wife from bleeding out on this table? So they put medications in my IV and it wasn't doing anything at this point. So that's when the panic really started to set in. So Michael, I say to Michael, Michael, I'm going to bleed out on this table. Like I can feel how much blood I'm losing. Nobody's in here to witness it. You need to do something because I can't do anything. So he opens the door to shout out to the nurse to get them in the room. And he overhears her on, you know, the, I don't know what, monitor walkie talkie thing that she has on her. What do you mean? She's not going to last 30 minutes. Well, the operating team on a Sunday at a county hospital was still 30 minutes out. And I'd already been bleeding for multiple minutes. When I tell you that the miracles that took place, as confirmed by the operating team, once they ultimately did arrive and see what had happened, go beyond any human understanding. Like this, and I, if you're listening to this and you don't believe in miracles and you're put off by me saying that, like, go screw. I don't care. I personally experienced it. I had so many people, other witnesses to that. It was the craziest thing because at that point, I had already lost 50% of my blood volume. Google what happens when a person loses 50% of their blood volume. They don't survive that. They don't survive that. So, and they're able to measure that by how much blood I ultimately had to receive. So then we're trying to figure out, okay, if they're 30 minutes out and I don't have 30 minutes, what can we do? So we're like, can you start a transfusion? You know, that transfusion I didn't want? Can you start the transfusion? No, we haven't found a match yet. We haven't cross-checked you yet. What do you mean you haven't cross-checked us? I've been here for 4 friggin' hours. What have you been doing this whole time? So like, there were just so many things of panic and panic and panic. Well, finally, Michael just screams at the top of his lungs, get the OB in here. And she comes down. She's like getting into her scrubs. And I look at her and I say, are you concerned? I'm laying upside down at this point. I'm like, are you concerned by how much blood I'm losing and when this operating team is going to arrive? She said, very. I would have had you on the operating table over 20 minutes ago. I said, okay, well, if I'm going to, well, back up. Then I said to her, am I going home to my children? I looked her right in the eye and I asked her, I said, I need to know, am I going home to my children? And she said, she paused. It was the world's longest pause, I assure you. Sure felt like it. And tears fill in her eyes. And she says, we are going to do the very best we can. And that's when it got very, very real. I guess at that point, I hadn't been considering that I'm going to die. But then everything shifted. So I said to her, okay, well, if I'm going to die, just do the surgery. You're the OB. You're going to do it without anesthesia. I'm going to pass out in a minute anyway. Like, if I'm not going to survive this, what do we have to lose? And she said, I can't do that. We have to intubate you. Like, you won't survive that surgery. You know, you've already lost too much blood. We don't even really know what's going to come next. When she said that to me, there was something that shifted in me that went from, I have to find the solution so that I don't die, right? We're trying to figure out what medications can they give me? Can they do a blood transfusion? Can they start the surgery right away? To, oh my gosh, I have to use this time I have left here in this room to tell my husband the things that he's going to need to hear to carry with him for a lifetime, since I won't be with him to be able to tell him in the future. Everything changed in that moment, where I got laser focused from that panic to, like, I need him to know what he needs to know. He needs to know how much I love him, and he needs to know what I want him to tell our children who will never see me again. And the doctor suggested strongly that we take that time. So that's when all the blood drained out of my husband's face. I thought he was going to need a transfusion alongside me, because it was when he came to that realization too. Whereas before that, it was all just like problem solving. He's such a problem solver. He's such a doer. He's so solution oriented. He's really steady in a storm. And he had been up to that moment. And then I just saw him go gray. I don't know. Maybe I looked the same, but I hadn't seen a person take that coloring. And I took his hands and I just said, you have done such a good job. You've done such a good job. And I love you so much. And I need you to know how much I love you. And I need you to raise our kids the way we've been called to raise our kids. I need you to, you know, homeschool them and pour principles into them that matter, that are a bedrock for how they're being raised. And I need you to tell them every single day individually, Jack, Marie, Evelina, Nadima, how much their mother loves them and how proud I've always been to be their mom. And you need them to chase heaven. Like, these kids need to chase heaven. I need to see them in heaven. And it was just all these things of, like, I had all these moments, all these thoughts pop into my head of, have I loved my husband enough for it to last him a lifetime? Have I imparted and instilled within my children what I need them to know that will carry them through a lifetime without a mother? And so often the answers to those questions are no. It's just not good enough, because who thinks like that when they aren't facing their mortality, right? Life creeps in. Other things that feel more urgent and important creep in. So no, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough time. It wasn't enough love. It wasn't enough focus. It wasn't enough wisdom given. Like, it's never going to be enough. A lot of the thoughts that came into my heart in those moments were totally around family, which was really not surprising to me, because that's what I always know is the center of my heart. But it was also really, you know, edifying and validating of, like, this is where my heart needs to be, right? I want to know that if I'm not here tomorrow, that they're going to be okay. And then other things that came into my mind too in this all too long window of time waiting for the operating team, where if I come out of this, I don't want to spend a single moment on anything that is not leading to significant impact in the world, and it isn't what God's calling me to do. Period. Point blank. End of story. Like, no more. No more. The things that I thought were important, the things that I convinced myself were of value, the things that kept me busy, go away. So finally, we got the nod that the operating team had arrived and they needed to rush me up to surgery. In that hallway ride, they're pushing my bed and Michael's running alongside me. Michael takes off his crucifix and puts it over my head. And it just sits on my chest. And I just felt, it felt so heavy. I like felt it there. And as soon as he did that, I had been panicking in that time, right? Not panicking, like my mind was panicking, right? Am I going to survive this? Oh my gosh, what's happening? It all just feels like, what the heck is happening? How is this happening? How did we get here? How did I lose my baby at 17 weeks? Like just all these thoughts are going through my head. And on the way up to surgery, we had to go up multiple floors. And as we're turning one of the hallways, there was this just standard hospital sign. I think it said like East Hallway or something, nothing important. But the sign just kind of morphed in my mind and I saw, let your will be done. Because up to that point, I had been negotiating with God. God, let me live. And if I live, let me keep my uterus. I want more babies. You know, I don't want to have a hysterectomy. And, you know, if I live, don't let me have to get a transfusion. I don't want a transfusion. Like all these just negotiations, like get me home to my children. And then all of a sudden it was just this moment of just let your will be done. I don't know what that will is. I'm not going to negotiate with you any longer. You know the path ahead and I trust you. And I felt a peace wash over me like I've never felt in my life. Like absolutely divine, miraculous peace wash over me. And I went from negotiating and panicking and asking questions to turning to Michael and so confidently saying, it's going to be okay. And it wasn't, it's going to be okay, I'm going to survive. Like, I didn't know that. I didn't know his will. But it was, I'm going to be okay, or it's going to be okay. I just trusted that. And I was able to comfort him in that moment. And I remember after him saying, spoiler alert, I survive. But I remember him saying to me, what was that? What happened to you in that hallway? Like, we were panicking and then all of a sudden you turn to me and you just take my hands and you tell me it's going to be okay. Where did that come from? And I said, that was 100% God. Like he just wrapped me in grace and carried me through that moment so that I could spill over into you. From that point, they took me up to a very brief moment in pre-op to prep me. And they had had a blanket over my body because I was so cold, which I appreciate. Except when you're bleeding out, I feel like the doctor should have some awareness of how much you're actually bleeding because I could tell that it was really bad. And we get up into the pre-op room and the anesthesiologist is asking me some questions. And I was like, listen, is everybody here that needs to be here to do this surgery? And he's like, yes. I'm like, then get me into the freaking operating room. And I lift the blanket off my lap and just blood pours off the table because the blanket had been, they had like four big blankets on me because I was shivering so much they kept bringing more hot blankets in. And they realized how, it was almost like there was a disconnect between the ER team and then the operating team. Like they hadn't informed the operating team how catastrophic things were. And they sent Michael out. He was fighting tooth and nail. He's like, I need to be in there. And obviously that was not going to be an option. So he lost that battle. And he had to wait in a waiting room alone. They said, oh, you know, this should, like, they kind of just prepped him for the worst. They're like, she's lost too much blood. And we can't even put her fully under anesthesia because her blood pressure is so low. We're having a hard time getting a reading. They were just kind of preparing him. Like, we are going to try a blood transfusion, but too much time may have passed. All of the things you don't want to hear about your spouse. And he goes off. I go off. You know, they bring me into the operating room. And then so they warned me, we can't put you under. You're going to be very aware of what's going on. We're going to do our best to make you comfortable. And then we get into the operating room. And it was so cold in there, but I was also so cold. And then I started convulsing. I don't remember. They had given me any medication yet at this point, but my body is just like writhing off the table. And they pull the bed up to the side of the operating table and they say, can you scoot yourself over? And I was like, I can't move my fingers and toes. Like, I can't move. So they lifted me up onto the table, the operating table, which had a big hole kind of by my lower half, I assume, so they could just get to whatever they needed to get to. And I'm laying there and I'm hearing this sound and I'm like, why? What is that faucet running? Like, what is that faucet running? What's pouring? Like, what's leaking onto the floor? And I look out to the left and the like turn my head just a little bit left of the bed, right of the bed, and I just see a pool of blood like pouring out both sides. And then I hear the one of the doctors say, you know, change the order to a massive transfusion. And it was my blood that I was hearing. But I wasn't panicked at that point. I think I was so far beyond that and I had been just really wrapped in God's peace at that juncture in the process. And they did give me medication, but it was not enough. I remember them jamming the tube down my throat for intubation. And you're awake, so your body's just rejecting it, gagging, trying to push it out. That was actually the most painful part after surgery, was my throat for about 5 days. It was so damaged and bruised internally because my body fought it so much going in and out that swallowing, talking, like just absolute, even just touching my neck was excruciating. I was in so much pain. I was like, oh my gosh, is this permanent? I don't know what's happening. It was so awful. So they started the surgery and they were able to, so we thought best case scenario, I would have a hysterectomy. Worst case scenario and more likely case scenario based on what they had told us, I wouldn't survive the surgery. And I remember waking up after and I couldn't really talk yet, you know, because you're still like you're really foggy. Like I had been out more than I was in that moment. And I'm kind of coming to and there was one of the nurses standing next to me and I couldn't really say much, but I could like speak in one word and, you know, phrases, sentences. And I just remember saying to him, like, first, husband. And he's like, yes, he's out there. We're going to bring you to him soon. And then I said, uterus. And he said, yes, you still have your uterus. Didn't have a hysterectomy. Thank God. And then I said, perforation, because I was so afraid they were going to like perforate me during the surgery. He said, no, everything went well. And I will never forget. It is burned into my memory in the best way when they were wheeling me out to see Michael and bringing me to post-op and just seeing him in the hall. He was just frozen, just tears streaming down his face, just frozen, staring at me like he was seeing a ghost, essentially. And I was still pretty foggy, so I couldn't say much. And just that moment, I don't know, I will never forget it. And it has bonded us in ways that, you know, you pray for your marriage to grow and to get better and to improve. And you just don't realize the rocky paths you're going to have to walk to get to the other side, right? We have a wonderful marriage. We have an incredible relationship, but it's hard raising 4 kids. Homeschooling, business, like life happens and it makes marriage take a backseat sometimes. So I'm often in prayer, just praying for us that we strengthen our marriage and we grow. And I could have never expected this to be the path that changes our trajectory in life, but it has been in so many ways. And that's been, again, one of the blessings that's come out of our agony and tragedy and struggle and heartache has been a deepening in our relationship like I could have never expected, so much deeper than anything we've ever had, where you just, after that moment, it was like, I see now how much of my life's calling is in him, like is in our family. And yeah, I'll just never forget that. So we get back to the post-op room where I learn more about Michael's experience through this whole thing, which was, you know, honestly, I think I had the better end of the deal because I at least was sedated during the worst part of everything, whereas he was sitting in this empty room by himself on the floor sobbing, assuming that he's never going to see his wife again, assuming they're going to hand him a bag of my stuff to take home and tell our children that their mother didn't survive something that they didn't even see coming. So he was telling me how in that time they had told him, you know, basically win, lose, or draw, we'll be out of here in about 30 minutes and you'll know what's going on. Well, an hour plus later, they're coming out. So he's assuming the worst. They ended up having to give me a massive blood transfusion. I ultimately lost almost 65% of my blood volume, which is typically not survivable. I personally experienced absolute miracles in that operating room that I'm just humbled by and forever grateful for and cannot explain. So I will not try and explain them, but I am here. So there's your evidence. And he said in that time, it was like a time warp, right? Similar to my experience prior to the surgery and everything. And he said he looked up and there was this crucifix on the wall, and he went over and he took the crucifix off the wall and he just held it in his arms and in his hands on the floor as he just sobbed. And he said he felt this same thing, like a knowing it's going to be okay, but that didn't in his mind mean he knew what the outcome would be. So when the doctor came in to talk to us, when we were in the post-op room in my recovery room that I was going to be in for a few days, she said the full placenta was intact. That was what was causing my bleeding. Because when you still have tissue remains after you deliver a baby, your body's smart and it's saying, this isn't supposed to be here. This is dead tissue. Like, this is going to cause infection. We need to get this out. And unfortunately, it's a little flawed in that how it gets it out is flushing it with blood, which can work, but it didn't in my case. So they were able to remove that placenta and give me a considerable transfusion to be able to recover. And then they had to use this balloon to put pressure on the wound in the uterus, all these different things. It doesn't matter. But when we heard that, we realized they were going to send me home. I was going to go home and take a nap and die in my sleep. Like, that was the trajectory. And then ultimately, that nurse had the courage to override a doctor who was out of his, you know, he was beyond his pay grade in making these decisions. And I was blessed enough to go home to my kids. And that time following going home to our kids was really a wild time. We chose not to tell them the intricate details of what happened to me. They knew what happened to their baby brother. They knew he had died the week before we told them. They knew he was in heaven. They knew mom was going to the hospital to deliver a baby, but we never fully went into detail. But I could not walk after that surgery. The surgery wasn't the issue. The surgery was fine. It was the blood loss. I couldn't walk. I couldn't hold my body weight up. I had to be taken to and from the bathroom for weeks. I couldn't lift our youngest daughter. Just so many humbling things that because of the level of blood loss, and I had some complications from the transfusion that thankfully worked out fine. I woke up a few days after and I was very jaundiced. I just looked in the mirror and I was just yellow, which is usually a sign of your body rejecting the transfusion, which thank God was not my situation. They had just pumped me with so much blood that my body wasn't going to be able to take all of those red blood cells, and that was its way of flushing them out. So there are just so many elements of the experience physically that were super humbling, super challenging, painful, uncomfortable, but they didn't even hold a candle to the emotional challenge. And I ping-pong back and forth between mourning our child and then trying to process what we just walked through. And it was a very difficult thing to have both. But what I realized in hindsight and in retrospect as I processed this, as I wrote 50 pages just every day, like if I had enough strength to sit up in the bed or even laying down, I'm just scribbling on these pages, trying to get out every little thing that happened, every thought I was having, trying to work through it. It was so challenging, but it was so cathartic to just get it out. What I realized was, I don't think, and this is hard to admit, I think based on my personality, my life experiences, just how I operate, how I've always operated, I'm very like grit through it, get through it kind of person. And I think it served me really well over the years in many areas of my life. But I'm afraid that if I hadn't been hit by a freight train physically. Like, if I hadn't gone through what I went through and been forced to just lay there for a month in my bed. I mean, I was in my bed over a month. I don't know if I would have mourned my son the way that I needed to. I think I would have picked up the pace to try and cover the pain, right? Filled my days with things that masked what I was navigating. So that was the first time in my life that I've fully processed a heartbreak like that, that I've ever really taken the time by default, like out of force, to really walk through what I was navigating. It was a really, I can't give you a play-by-play on that, nor do you probably want one. It was a wild ride. But one of the wonderful things that came from it was, because of how physically just unable I was to do really anything, everything had to come off my calendar. Like, there was no working, there was no nothing for several weeks. And in that, man, how God performs many versions of just triumphs and miracles, we shined. My team shined. They came in and did what only they could do, that I probably was overshadowing being so present in everything. And I was just wrapped up in love by my clients and just all of you, like everybody. It just was so incredible. It was so incredible. And I'd never experienced something like that. And also what it did was kick my butt back into my rightful position within my business, which is not in the every moment of every day, right? It was in that visionary leadership zone that I belong in, where all I could do was think. All I could do was think and contemplate and imagine and envision. And that's really what I should primarily be doing. So everything has changed since then in the best ways. That's like another episode, another part of this crazy story. But it's unified our family. It's clarified our mission as a family. It's clarified our vision and mission within our business. And I can tell you right now, second chances, they are not meant to be wasted. Like, I have never been so convicted and alive and caring less about external forces that give opinions or try and tell you what box you're supposed to fit in. Like, it's just been so validating for what God has placed on my heart. Like, there is no denying it. There is no saying no to it. He's like, I handed you your life on a silver platter for this second round. The first time you were squandering it a little bit. This time, that's it. This is your second chance. You take it, you leave it, right? I'm taking it. I'm all in. And what I want to tell you too is, in that time, I said to myself, all right, I am going to give myself 2 weeks. I am going to give myself 2 weeks to allow my emotions to drive the train. And at that 2 week point, I am going to take this second chance. I am going to live. And it didn't mean that I was going to ignore my feelings or stuff them down or not address them or not feel them. It meant that they didn't get to make the decisions anymore. I was going to take actions that I knew were in alignment with what God was calling me to, who I was being called to become and how I was being called to lead in all areas of my life. And I was going to embrace the blessings alongside that suffering. So I got up one day and 2 weeks in, you know, being guided to the bathroom mirror, I had a dry erase marker. And I wrote on that mirror where I was going to see it, I am alive, right? I am still here with my 4 incredible children who need me. My son is in heaven in the arms of Jesus and being wrapped up in love by my nana and my jiddo and my grandmother and my great aunt and all the people who are loving him so much right now. I still have my uterus. So if God wants me to have more children, we'll see what he has in cards for our family. And I am still here living alongside my husband, who I love madly, who I got a second chance at life with, and I'm not going to waste that. What a gift. You don't need this catastrophic life event to realize that you too woke up this morning. You too were given a second chance. Right? Like, I had so many people coming out of the woodwork being like, oh, God must have big plans for you. You're still here. It's like, so are you. You might not have walked through something crazy and obvious, but you woke up this morning, still blood in those veins, still breath in those lungs. So what are you going to do with it? There's so much coming, guys. I can't even begin to explain the clarity and the calling that has been placed on my heart that it would take another freight train to stop me. So God willing, that doesn't happen. But I am here. I am grateful. Thank you for letting me share. There is kind of a part three to this, but this is it for today. That's all I can handle. But thank you. And please don't hesitate to reach out. I've gotten so many messages from so many people who have walked through their own hardships like this too. And we're not alone. I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned in terms of the community aspect of it and sharing the story. I was very insular for about a month plus, and then it became very evident God was calling me to share this, and I couldn't understand why. I was like, I don't want to. That's not in the cards for me. And then I remember kind of negotiating, and I was like, okay, well, you know what, God, maybe I'll just like share some nuggets that I learned from it and like keep it a little bit more on brand. And then it was very obvious that that's not what he was asking of me. So I decided I was going to share it. And from that moment forward, things have really shifted. Doors are opening. Clarity is coming, and we're seeing massive impact from sharing. So I'm going to keep doing that despite the fact that it's very unnerving and difficult. But thank you for listening. More to come, and big expectations of what the second chance is going to look like. And I want it to ripple effect into your life, because you too are called to big things. You too are a visionary leader, and you too are not called to play small or by the rules of what the world tells you. You too are called to big things and not called to play by the rules of what the world tells you you're supposed to be, but who you know you are called to be, and having the courage to step into that. I hope today's episode gave you what you needed. If it spoke to you, please leave us a review and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on the next powerful episode. And I know it's so cliche to ask for a review. It always feels weird asking for one, but you guys, that makes a huge impact on the show. We read every one of them, and it helps us get incredible guests to serve you. Don't be shy. I love connecting with our listeners. You can follow along on Instagram when I'm on there, at Eliz Hartke. And if there's a topic or a question or a guest you have for us, reach out, share your thoughts. You can connect at marketing@luminaryleadershipco.com. And we do this for you. So the more you tell us, the more we can serve you. Thanks for spending some time with me. I really do appreciate you. Tune in next week to keep building your legacy and becoming the confident visionary leader you are meant to be.